All right, Eric, we're in research world again for expert to expert. How are you
doing? Yeah, good. Thank you. So, yeah, we're in Building 99, so we're visiting the natural language processing team. And so we have Michael, Lucy, and Chris. So why don't you guys introduce yourself? Why don't we start with Chris and then move from right to left?
Okay.
So my name is Chris Quirk. I'm a researcher in the Natural Language Processing Group, and I tend to focus mostly on the problem of machine translation. So say we're given texts in English, and we'd like to translate them into Spanish or German or Japanese. And as you can imagine, there's a large variety of natural language problems in moving text from one language to another. So that's what I spend most of my time on.
Excellent.
And my name is Lucy Vanderwende, and I have spent most of my time working on something we call MindNet, which is a semantic knowledge base that we automatically extract from processing text.
Hmm.
So we can talk about that later on.
Interesting.
I'm Michael Gammon. I did a whole range of things in the group. So I started out writing the German grammar for what's now the German Grammar Checker in Word. And then moved through various stages, got involved a little bit with machine translation, but most recently it's mostly been work on sentiment detection, analysis of English written by non-native speakers and sort of trying to correct errors that non-native speakers make.
The
most recent things.
So I'd like to kind of, go into that because, and one of the things that, often happens in email conversations, right, because, like emotions are not very kind of, very hard to grasp in text, and then things kind of, explode and you get flame wars. Is that something that you're going to solve with your kind of,
Knowing Michael, he's not going to promise that.
Oh, he's good.
No, we're actually with the English as a second language set of things that we're doing, we're targeting more sort of grammatical type errors. So, for example, I mean, no matter which language you come from, what your native language is, people always have trouble with prepositions because prepositions are very language specific. So whether you're a Russian native speaker or a Chinese native speaker, picking the right preposition in English in the right context is not trivial. So that's one of the errors we target, making suggestions there and determiners, articles, is it the or is it a, or do you have no article at all? That's very hard for some people. So that's, we're at that level. The flame wars will... next year.
Okay, but it's easier than German, right? Where it's like das, den,
Oh, yeah. So... You only have three predictions to make in the distinction in English. So.
But you can see this for yourself. There's now a website where we have a very early prototype up, and that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's www.eslassistant.com.
Okay. Yeah. So I've been saved.
You have to be a scientist to figure out the URL.
Yes.
we'll put that in the text.
Cool.
I must say I've been saved many times by kind of claiming, I'm not a native speaker, but now if we have all these tools, there goes my excuse. So Lucy, I would like to talk to you a little bit about what kind of mathematics or things do you use in your work? The underlying mathematics, I'm kind of interested in.
So actually, the math, you want to talk to Chris.
Okay.
But I can tell you. So I'm more interested in extracting a level of representation that's more abstract than the surface string.
Okay.
So I actually want to get the computer to be able to give the analysis that you were taught in middle school and high school, like what is the subject, what is the object, and do that level of abstract analysis. And that's important when you talk about text understanding, because if I say, I read the book with Mary, or if I said, the sentence would be like John told Bill some story, and Bill told John some story, that's two different pictures in your mind. So you need to be able to do the text analysis to do that. And we do have mathematical models for doing that. Or you could, but that's the level of abstraction that I'm aiming for.
Okay, so do you build like some kind of parse tree or something?
Yes.
Because, okay.
Yes, absolutely. And there are different ways to build parse trees. And that's evolved over the last 20 years. How you build parse trees is really changed.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take away from the goal that you want to construct some form of abstract representation that is more than just the surface words.
Yeah. And so what kind of parsers do you guys use to kind of, you know, to parse the...
All and any.
Yeah.
Okay. But are you using like Lex and Yuck or, you know, or that probably not, or
not
recursive
really.
Descent or... Yeah.
It's more exhaustive than that. So this is one of those fundamental differences between constructed programming languages and natural languages. So Lex and Yak are fantastic tools when you have a hand-constructed grammar for a language like C or C++, where there's intentionally minimal ambiguity. Human languages are almost totally the opposite. You know, sometimes you look at the language and you think somebody tried to make it as ambiguous as they possibly could.
Intentionally.
Yeah.
I mean, no, but it's for efficiency reasons.
That's true.
That's true.
Can you explain that? Is that for efficiency, like between
human
communication?
Right. If I had to be explicit about everything, we'd be sitting here for hours upon hours. But instead, I can give you a very short signal, which may be ambiguous, but in the context that I'm communicating is actually not very ambiguous, right? So I don't have to have full specification.
So, and one of the other differences also is that with constructed languages, generally, you look for the parse, right? Like, there is a unique representation, which is the true syntactic analysis of this fragment of C code. With human languages, there's no such opportunity, right? Like, so if I... One of these classic examples is, I saw the man with the telescope. So there's at least two potential readings. One is, I was using a telescope to look at a man who was all the way over there. And the other is, I was standing here, and there's a guy over there, and he has a telescope sitting right beside him. And there's nothing in that sentence in particular which tells you what the right analysis is.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having like an acceptor as a grammar, we have kind of a ranker. It comes back and it says, these are what I think are the most likely constituents, or these are what I think the syntactic analysis looks like. But one of the important issues is that human language is very ambiguous. And so some of the advances that I think have really been made over the past 10 or so years is to try to preserve as much ambiguity as possible in our representations. So don't find a single parse, but find a forest that represents the possible interpretations of a sentence. And how can we find algorithms that can quickly find those in, like, you know, no more than cubic time and get a ranked representation of them? How can we learn from parses that have been annotated by humans how we should rank parses of new incoming sentences?
Okay, and so like kind of going back to when you said, you know, you wrote kind of a grammar for German.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a student, I did also a little bit of you know, computational linguistics. So I was involved in doing kind of grammar for Dutch.
Excellent.
Sorry?
Where was that?
In Nijmegen. So this
like
a corpus linguistics. So yeah, can you tell me a little bit, because we talked now the difference between, like, you know, natural languages and computer language. So what are the challenges to kind of defining the grammar for a natural language?
Right. Yeah. So just to set the context again, right? So this was about when I started. That was 12 years ago, right? So that was a time when you would still do this massive investment in having a linguist, you know, write up the rules. So the difficulty, I mean, for German, It's hard to explain to somebody. For you, it'll be easy because your background is Dutch. But for English native speakers, they often tend to think that every language is, in many ways, as simple as English. You know, English has very few word endings, for example. You know, you have the ing, you have the s,
ed.
And ed, right.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
So, whereas a language like German has this very rich morphology, which means, you know, a given word can appear in many different forms depending on what role it plays.
Yeah.
So, you know, nouns can inflect differently for what case they're in, what number they're in, etc. So you gotta, that's one level of challenge. So you have this very rich information there that you gotta pass out correctly and combine correctly, because a given determiner and a given inflection will more likely belong to, you know, one noun than another, etc. Then there's the problem with the ambiguity. You got to make decisions when you don't have the complete information that a human has. When I process a sentence, you know, when I listen to somebody speaking German, as Lucy said, you know, you have the context around it, you have the world knowledge, you have all of that. If you're just looking at lexical items and they have all kinds of annotations and labels on them, but that's still a sort of a poor representation compared to what you have in your mind. So making decisions based on that information is very hard. And then often, as you build a parse tree from the bottom up, you know, you often have local information only. You've got to make decisions about the phrase boundaries by looking at a part of the sentence when, you know, 15 more words are coming.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, like one of the big problems, I think, in parsing, and I think that's true for a lot of languages, is coordination. You know, the seemingly innocent little words and or, you know, the things you can combine with them and what the scope is of that and what the scope is of material that's outside of a coordination, how it, you know, influences what's inside. That's very, very tricky. And German has a much freer word order, so now I'm getting from one thing into the next. has a much freer word order, which also makes it difficult because it's not that you have your subject and your verb and your object. You sometimes can have, you know, the verb in certain configurations appears at the end and everything else is jumbled in front of it. So
yeah. So you're talking about like differences in languages. So one of the things that always surprises me is that it seems to be that older languages are more complicated than kind of, you know, newer languages, like if you look at Latin or even German and Dutch, right? And so is that true, or is that, you know, so as languages evolve, do they get kind of grammatically simpler? Or am I just kind of, you know...
I would say none of us is expert enough on this topic to be able to address that.
Okay.
Because really that's, you need to talk with people who really study kind of how languages evolve. But I do know one person who used to be in this group, and she had studied creoles.
Yep.
And creoles are usually simpler than the parent languages. And to the degree that any new language might actually be creolization of the languages that it is in contact with, maybe.
Yeah, because the funny thing is with programming languages is it's the opposite. Like, you know, they get more and more complex over time. So there's a kind of nice duality kind of, you know, going on here.
But I think, I mean, actually in historical developments in languages, I mean, I think you see both processes. You see, you know, simplifications where something starts out maybe with very rich morphology, just to use that as an example. So, you know, many, many different forms of a word. And then they sort of collapse into, you know, a simpler paradigm. But you also see the opposite, where something starts out simple and then, you know, suddenly endings develop. So I think it's... Yeah, I would be skeptical about it.
Okay.
That things go become always simpler. It's maybe before the elections they tend to be. So I don't want to go there.
So another question is, like, now we talked a little bit about like parsing and kind of, you know, determining the structure. So what kind of, you know, comes after that? So what do you guys do with, you know, once you have kind of, you know, parsed the sentence and found the structure, what is the next step?
So, well, actually, when you might want to talk about machine translation, because
that's
something that we can do now that we have a parse. Mm-hmm. We can do better machine translation.
Yes. So so one of the great challenges for machine translation systems these days is, how can we get the words in the right order? And I mean, this sounds like a really simple, stupid thing, you know? You just put the verb here and you put the noun there, but it's actually a really challenging problem. So, especially as we move between languages that have very different backgrounds, like translating from English to Japanese, the language changes a lot. So English tends to put the subject at the beginning of the sentence and the verb right after it and then the object after that. Japanese instead takes the verb and puts it all the way at the end. It turns its prepositions into postpositions and so on and so forth. And a lot of these generalizations are difficult to capture if you just look at natural language sentences as a sequence of tokens. But if you start looking at it as a syntax tree, as something that has a notion of the category of each of these types of words and how they combine to form larger structures, then we can come up with simple generalizations about how words move from language to language. So some of our recent work has been developing machine translation systems that are statistical and corpus-based. So they learn how to translate based on existing pairs of source and target sentences, but are informed by syntactic information and use that to help guide decisions about how words should be reordered and also how little words like in and the and should be changed as translation happens. So, I mean, machine translation, we kind of use it as a source of deeper information about the sentence. And I think that's pretty common in other areas, right? It can be used as a feature, as a source of features to make complex decisions, for instance, in, like, sentiment classification.
Yeah, we have used parse tree features in the past. I mean, it's a little bit of a more expensive feature because you got to compute the parse first and then use those features, but you can show that actually it helps at least a little bit over just using the words. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's MindNet is also something that we should get to,
right.
where we take, you know, you start out with a sentence, you go to a parse tree, but then you actually use the parse tree to construct a more semantic
representation. You interpret the parse tree to a more abstract semantic level so that you can say who did what to who, when, where, and how, answering the typical reporter questions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can say, and then if you have that level of representation and you parse a large body of text, then you can start to ask questions like, where do birds live? Well, they live in trees and nests in North America, and you know, you get kind of a funny kind of answer, but still it's something more than what you would get just by looking at the text. And in fact, that's what we did a long time ago for Encarta. It has a natural language interface. You can say, you know, what animals eat insects?
Mm-hmm.
And you will get a list of animals that eat insects, and it will no longer contain the list that says the insects are eating the animals, which is, there are some insects that eat animals, but you'll only get the ones. Whatever. But, yes.
Yeah.
But, and that's kind of the beginnings of what you might call semantic search. You know, you want to get at that deeper level of representation. And whether you say that somebody was assassinated or somebody was killed or somebody was, you know,
murdered.
However that's expressed in text, if I ask who killed Kennedy, all of those should come back. And that's you know, kind of getting to that level of representation is very important.
Yes, and so how far are we from kind of, you know, being able to kind of, you know, search the web by, you know, natural language queries?
Well, there's still a lot of hurdles. The size, you know, we have you know, it takes time to parse.
Mm-hmm.
We have pretty accurate parsers. We have pretty accurate components that go from the parse to the semantic level. And we have rich lexical resources so that we know that, say, kill and assassinate are synonyms, or, you know, other examples of synonyms. But what we're still missing are the identification of larger paraphrases. So if I say, Yoko Ono was married to John Lennon, or Yoko Ono, John Lennon's widow, in some sense they're conveying the same meaning,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's a very different structure, and you can't get from one to the other just by knowing one synonym. So that is the challenge for us. That's kind of what we have taken as our research challenge, is the identification of structural paraphrase. And it's that is kind of still a stumbling block. So wherever we can rely on one word to be changed, that's fine.
Okay.
And the syntax and, you know, the deep structure, that's all fine. We've got that covered. And it's just a matter of parsing that amount of text. But it's these larger phrase chunks. That's the challenge.
Okay, so trying to connect the two of you there. So you talked about machine translation, and then you talked about the kind of, you know, the semantic structure of a sentence. So you know, it appears to me often that like one language has more expressive power than the other. So, you know, like if you take a book in English and you translate it in Dutch, you know, the Dutch book is like, you know, I think 10-20%. You know, thicker, because, you know, is that just kind of syntax, or is there kind of, do languages have really kind of a difference semantically in expressive power?
No, I nobody is going to say that they have different semantic powers.
Well, but some people say, like, Germans, like, you know, the reason that there are so many philosophers, you know, is because the German language is, you know, really good in expressing, you know, ideas really precisely, and so.
Yeah, there's a lot of notions like that, but I think if you ask, I mean, in the linguistics community, I think it's pretty much a given that it's an accepted fact that you know, There are a lot of value judgments like that about languages, but when you actually look at the structure and what can be expressed, you know, there's no language that is poorer at something or another one that is better at something. And you know, it's also, I mean, think of it, it can be a little bit dangerous, right? Because you could make the opposite argument and say, well, this language, you know, whoever grows up in that country is not going to be good at X because the language.
Yes,
which
yes,
is,
yes.
There's
yes,
some
okay,
basic
yeah, but
implications.
That was, yeah, but definitely, that was definitely you didn't not the kind it. Of the direction right. I was, but it's like interesting because, like, again, if we take the analogy with programming languages, there you do have, like, certain languages that look different, but, you know, are semantically the same, but you also have other languages that are semantically quite different. Their semantic structure is quite different, which makes it kind of, you know, hard to translate between them. So it was kind of, you know, that's where the question
there,
came
there
from.
Are
like
these
structural differences.
There, yeah. are, there are these phenomena that are not expressible, not as easy, phenomena that you don't have to express in English, but, for example, that you do have to express in another language. We express tense. We have to be explicit about whether it's something is true now, was true, or will be, you know, could be true, yeah. right? We have, generally speaking, three tenses. There are languages that do not have such an explicit, you know, where it's encoded on the verb, mm. right? And they don't need to express it that way. There are other languages that are don't need to express the number, like whether it's one or more, in the same way. There are other languages where you have to, but each language has its own needs. So there are mm-hmm. languages yes. that are known in Africa where you have to express whether you know something for a fact, whether it was told to you, whether you believe it to be true. We encode some of these, but not all of them. Yeah. Hmm. And so there are some things that are hard to translate, but everything that's expressible in one is expressible in the other.
Okay.
I mean, think about politeness markers, for example.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, in English is very informal in that sense mm-hmm. because, you know, we never met until today, but, you know, we just call each other you.
Yep,
you know,
exactly.
no problem. In German, it's already a little bit more complicated because there's
you
do and see.
Herr Meyer, right?
Yeah, well, it depends. But, you know, there's already a distinction. And it's actually, if you meet somebody on the street, you know, you don't want to yeah. become informal too quickly because that's rude. You know, then you have a language like Japanese that has a much more sophisticated system of honorifics where, you know, it not only depends on a politeness level, but it depends on whether you're sort of outside of my group or inside of my group, whether you're on some hierarchy, you're higher or you're lower, etc.
Yeah.
Does that mean that in English you'll always be rude? No. You know, I mean, we can express politeness even if we don't have these markers. We just would do it differently.
But now suppose I want to translate from English to Japanese.
Yes.
And now
so
how do I kind of insert
very difficult.
Those? Yeah.
That is
yeah.
true.
The sad answer is badly. it's an ongoing struggle. And right now we try to learn from existing data. So one answer is we look for the most prevalent forms that are in the data set that we learn from. Or we hope to pick up from context what
yeah.
might be the most appropriate set of honorifics or politeness markers or definiteness or all these attributes. Mm-hmm. But the longer-term answer is I think we need some deeper semantic representation. I mean, it sounds like to get this stuff right, you really need to have artificial intelligence, which
sure.
is a scary thing to say. But you need to know, hey, I'm this guy in this organization, and I'm talking to my boss's boss, and so
yes.
I need to be as polite as possibly I possibly can, and how that might be expressed differs language by language. But
it all
sure.
depends on context.
Yeah. So right now we're kind of muddling in the ground with simpler forms, things that we can actually compute efficiently and do pretty well. And, you know, translation quality is getting better, but a lot of these natural language problems are just kind of scary because they really touch on what is intelligence. And I don't think any of us quite know yet.
Right, and by and large, you know, we're processing one sentence at a time.
Sure. Yes.
Obviously, you're not going to get what the right level of politeness is doing it one sentence at a time. So, yeah,
so you basically have removed culture from the equation, right? So languages don't happen in a vacuum. They happen
That's
inside
right.
of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing with the simple tools that you have, which are the programming languages that Eric and his friends create, are, you know, not going to give you that ability to understand that, I mean, this is Japanese string. Let me go look at an abstract cultural syntax tree and map all the stuff I need to map, and then all of a sudden change into English where it makes sense, right? You can't do that.
We can't do that yet. No.
But that's where you're going to try to go. How would you do that? I mean, even with artificial intelligence.
Well, there's some cases where you simply don't have the information, right? I mean, if you really are supposed to translate a piece of text in isolation, where, let's say, one person addresses another, and it's written in English, and you want to go to Japanese, if you only have that piece of text and no additional information about who are these people that I mentioned and what is their relationship to each other, it's underspecified. I mean, the best thing you can do is you can go neutral, so you won't be offensive. You know, don't go to extremes in either way. So there's simply cases where you just don't have that. You just can't do anything. There are cases, you know, let's say you're translating in a context, in an office context, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say, we're translating an email. Now we may have an org chart, you know, so we may know who the person, who the author of the email is, who the sender is, who the recipient is. So you could, you know, at least you would have the information. You could potentially use that. But that's beyond what anybody does today. I mean, it's really just, I mean, just getting the order of words right, and the basic meaning right is, and it seems strange because, you know, your average 3-year-old can do it, but that's one of the miracles, is really that, you know, kids pick up a language as if it's nothing, and it's not until you study it that you realize how difficult it actually is.
Well, so kids are situated, right? The way we study language, the way we process, the computer processes languages, you know, it's not in a context. It doesn't have the need to know. It doesn't have the extra linguistic input, you know, that there's 5 people sitting here. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of that's necessary.
It doesn't have
gaze.
Or stimulus feedback. Yeah, right. It doesn't say
or
food
voice.
And then get food and put into its mouth. You know?
Right. So that is kind of a good point. So one of the things, if with human interaction, there's often a dialogue, right? Because if I say something to you and you don't really understand it, you can ask me. But it seems that when we're dealing with interacting with computers, we're not really leveraging this dialogue, right? You know, we're drawing something and there's never the computer asks me something, you know, did you mean this or no, it says, you know, it's wrong. But would that be something where we can kind of use, you know, a more dialogue approach to make these things kind of work better?
So dialogue sets up a lot of expectations for users that there's actual understanding going on. Mm-hmm. And so quickly the computer does not meet those expectations and those efforts fail. And so kind of getting conversational agents in the computer has been really iffy and has not met with success, right? But you could almost see like the query suggestions. So you go to any search engine right now, type in your query. There's a list of related searches.
True.
It's almost a little bit like a dialogue, right?
Yes.
It's not changing your query. It's saying, hey, is this in the direction?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of the beginning of the computer giving its best guess as to what you want, in addition to giving you the results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I must say, personally, I often rely on that, right? Because I just type something and then it's like, you know, you don't have to think, you just click on that. So it's I think that's a very natural kind of way to kind of, you know, it's like a little bit more trial and error.
Right. And you don't have too high expectations because the computer's not saying, did you want this or this? Now, that might be what people would love to play with because you would actually create the illusion of intelligence. But in point of fact, the computer will very soon, you know, kind of fall on its knees there. So it's all about setting the right user expectations. And that was, for example, key with machine translation. Machine translation has gone through boom-bust cycles. But you have to get the application right so that people have the correct set of expectations about what machine translation can do, and then it can be very helpful.
Hmm. Yeah, so you're talking about boom-bust cycles and artificial intelligence. That seems to be, you know, a field that goes through kind of, you know, giant hype where we overpromise and then underdeliver, and it kind of, you know. So where are we, you know, it's been, you know, a while that, you know, I mean, when I was a professor, I even used to teach artificial intelligence, but, you know, I haven't followed it for kind of many years. So, and obviously this is like important for this field. So do you guys know what the state of the art is there? What is, you know,
it's a very philosophical question.
Yes.
And we might all have different perspectives.
Yeah, but that's great.
That's great.
So. Yeah.
So I think a lot of the focus, because of some of these boom-bust cycles, has shifted from the high, lofty goals of artificial intelligence down to what people now call machine learning. And it's still a complex problem, but it's much simpler. So one of my favorite examples of a simple machine learning system is I had a friend who interned at a ketchup-making company. And they had this machine where all the tomatoes would go through, and they'd have to pick for each tomato. They would say, should we put this on the shelves because it's bright and shiny and red and it looks nice, or is it kind of yellow and spotted and ugly and should we make ketchup out of it? And so it had to look at some image of the tomato and decide ketchup or not ketchup. And
that's funny.
Yeah, it was a great intern project, actually. Yeah. But so then you can look at all sorts of features to try to make this decision, right? Like I could have a camera, I could have some little sensor that pushes it on a little bit. And so we have, if I think mathematically, I could represent these as like a vector of real numbers. Mm-hmm. And maybe I want to find some other vector that when I dot product them, the dot product is positive if it's a ketchup and negative if it's not a ketchup mm-hmm. tomato. So the focus has been, how can I focus on relatively simple scenarios where machines can learn from human annotated data? And I think a lot of really interesting work in AI is going on right there. It's not like the full, can I talk to my computer, you know, it's not a true answer to artificial intelligence yet, but it seems to, it's a little more grounded approach to try to find problems that we can really solve. And, I mean, maybe it's on the path towards true intelligence. If you look at simple animals, maybe that's all they're really learning from their environment anyway. So I don't know. It seems like because of this overpromise underdeliver, people have scaled back and focused on really sound, understandable problems that they can solve and they can make an impact on. And now I see machine learning popping up everywhere, right? It's hitting natural language processing. It's hitting tomato sorting. But it's also going into machines even, like branch prediction inside processors. They're starting to talk about doing machine learning to pick which branch you should predict. I mean, crazy stuff. So, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. And so what about you?
So the part of AI that most touches on NLP is knowledge representation.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where are they on the boom-bust cycle?
Yes, because like, you know, it is like all the whole kind of semantic web and
right.
RDF and, you know.
Right. They all need linguists, by the way. I mean, that's clear. yeah, it's interesting. With all this emphasis on RDF and where you would propose to store the knowledge in triples, triples are not enough. And there are some people in the AI community who are working on that. But if I say, you know, an Indian elephant, that's an elephant that has small ears. And an African elephant is an elephant that has large ears. Okay, it's true that elephants have ears, but not all of them have large ears, and not all of them have small ears. So I do need something more than triples.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a contextual triple. Like, it's true that elephants have ears, or that ears can be small in the context of Indian elephant, and ears can be large in the context of an African elephant, but it's not the case that all ears are small or all ears are large. And that's a problem that RDF representation is going to hit real soon.
So do you believe that you know, that we will go to a semantic web, or do you think that will that be that RDF is not expressive enough be the limit, or you know that you know how can we? I always feel how can we extract from you know from the web that semantic information automatically? That seems to me like you know a giant problem.
Well, so there are two problems. So I mean, MindNet really kind of naively did that without thinking about it. You know, that's what our project really was. Extracting semantic knowledge from text. And but there are two fundamental problems. So one is the representation and which inferences you can draw from a given representation, which ones are valid, which ones are not valid. The second is, what is the necessary and sufficient set of relations that hold? So, you know, most semantic web projects know about places, people. Maybe they know something that X is a company, that companies have CEOs, and there's certain types of relations that you can know upfront, predict. There are supervised, semi-supervised methods for learning that type of information. That's all that can be done. But it's limited, because you have to know beforehand what you're looking for. And so to me, the real challenge is, can you detect valid relations directly from the text, ones that you're not necessarily looking for beforehand? Because otherwise, it's simply, you know, kind of creating a gigantic structured database. And so is the semantic web that, or is it something more? And if it's something more, it needs to solve the problem of automatically inducing the relation types that are interesting for that field, for example. And different fields talk about things in different ways. And that's, again, this problem of structured paraphrase, where, you know, if you take text from the biology and then you take text in the pharmaceutical industry, they may be talking about the same thing, but it may be in very different terms. Now, in order to make progress and in researching some new drug to cure or suppress some disease, you'll want to see these similarities. I mean, that's the promise. But you can't go at it with a predefined set of relations. And there's no single ontology either. I mean, a lot of people in semantic web would like to believe that there's a single ontology. And there is no single ontology that will be sufficient for all areas.
Yes, and so what about if we can go a little bit deeper here maybe. So what about, like, you know, the logics to kind of reason about knowledge, right? So it's like, you know, because a lot of classical logic doesn't work, so you need to have non-monotonic logic and so on. Do you think that normal people can kind of, you know, understand those things? Or, you know, what is the...
Right. So that, I would say, we don't have any specific expertise in that area, but just yesterday we had a great talk from a young researcher who's writing up his thesis at Stanford University. His name is Bill McCartney. And he's creating something called natural logic, which is less powerful than first-order logic, but not all sentences can be translated into first-order logic, but all sentences can be translated into this particular logic. So it's a subset that's specifically designed to handle phenomena in natural language. And I think that that's really promising. I really enjoyed his talk. So.
Okay, so now you're not escaping, you know, the
AI question. Yeah. I mean, I'm very pessimistic about it. I think, you know, there's great useful things we can do with language. I think there's ways in which we can study and incorporate linguistic structure and language structure to do even more useful things. So I do believe in all of those things. So in a sense, it's like if you carve out little pieces of, if you want to call it intelligence, you know, we can, once you have a tractable problem, I think there's a number of useful things you can do. When it comes to the big AI, the real artificial intelligence, originally I come from a literature background, so, you know, through literature into linguistics and then in computational linguistics. And I always think, I mean, if you look at a small poem, you know, and if you consider that like a really... you know, sort of like a little bit of the essence of what a human mind can do. Good luck.
Yes.
You know, that's
that
if that is the standard, and I think it should be when you talk about human intelligence, then it's just it's getting to any of those higher, you know, functions. I think it's I don't believe in it, but that's it's a philosophical question.
I
agree to disagree with whoever is more optimistic.
So then, you know, so one question I would like to ask, another question I'd like to ask each of you, is like, you know, in your kind of particular field of expertise, what is the hardest problem, you know, the hardest open problem at this point? What kind of, you know, keeps you awake at night? Or when, you know, if you would solve that, you would be kind of world famous, you would get, you know, the Turing Award or...
Yeah, having... You know, having something that resembles understanding to a greater degree than what we have today. You know, when I work with sentiment detection, it's you get very far, you get very good techniques. If you have some labeled training data, let's talk about product reviews, for example. You know, you have some humans annotate sentences, well, this is positive, this is negative, this is neutral. You train a classifier just using words or word pairs as features. You know, you get really high accuracy, but of course you don't get 100%. And what do you miss? Well, you miss the things where the more complex linguistic structures come in, and where more context comes in. You miss irony, you miss sarcasm. You know, how do you
all
deal
the
with
things I love.
Yeah, I know. Well, they're not going to replace you with a computer. So, you know, having a level of understanding that goes beyond what we currently have at the string level, or even at the parse tree level, where you could, you know, start to make sense of things like irony and sarcasm. But then again, it's so difficult. You know, it's. I don't think there's a solution inside, but...
Okay, and so what about you, Lucy?
Hi, I've had some time to think about this, so that's good. So, I mean, I think that's the thread that goes in our group is to want something, you know, understanding should be something beyond the string level. So there are different levels, you know, irony, sarcasm. But there's also... So context. So, you know, right now we parse one sentence at a time, but the ability to parse a text as a coherent whole, that's one step. Beyond that, I really would love to see the day where we can have and understand what allows certain conversations to be good conversations and certain conversations to be dysfunctional. What allows us to have a cooperative conversation that's way beyond what it is that we're saying? Mm-hmm. And there are certain non sequiturs. You know, I can say something and you'll say something and the conversation breaks down. But usually we feed on each other and you build a conversation. And what are those building blocks? So if I say, oh, you know, I fell down on my bicycle yesterday, and you say, oh, you know, did you get hurt? For that to be a cooperative response, there's an immense amount of information that needs to be go on. You need to have this AI notion, though I don't think it needs to only come from AI, that if you fall off your bicycle, you expect to be hurt, and that's what you're responding to. You're not responding to the words that I've said. You're responding to expected consequences. And to actually illuminate what makes conversation tick.
Mm-hmm. There's also the empathy, right? I mean, it's like, why would you care if somebody else gets hurt? Well, right. You do care because you're a human being.
And there's theories of politeness.
Yes,
maybe you can even say,
like, you know, did you get hurt?
If we're a competitor.
Yes, yeah.
But I think conversation, I mean, it's way beyond our reach right now. Mm-hmm. But I think that would be truly fascinating.
Yeah, and what also would be nice if there would be a prosthetic kind of brain that helps me kind of, you know, get the conversation going. Because as you say, sometimes you're in a conversation and it kind of just...
Yes.
And then, So it would be nice if, you know, this little bird would tell me, yeah, you know, maybe you should say this. And
or if I'm meeting you for the first time and I don't know anything about Holland, which luckily I do, but I could have some quick fact sheet so that I have something. Because I think in order to create a conversation, you need something to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's maybe what a lot of conversations are. And I've been thinking, for example, how much of our conversation is contributed by what we hear and read, say, on the radio, on television. Mm-hmm. It would be really interesting to measure how much of water cooler conversation is directly tieable to the media.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it would be fascinating.
Yeah, and scary, too, because now maybe you can kind of, you know, influence that, too, right,
by
manipulating the media. Would be a great way to do advertisement, you know. Get people talk about your product or something.
Right. But it would be interesting to see what is it that we talk about. What's considered good conversation, and that's, you know, I think that would illuminate something about, you know, how humans communicate and what we think about.
Yep. So, and what about you? What is kind of, you know, your in your area the kind of, you know, the hardest problem that, you know, you would face?
I'm tempted to repeat exactly what Michael said, which is that a deep understanding is just this holy grail, right? So really knowing what's going on inside language is really tempting. But maybe a slightly shorter-term goal that I don't know if it would get to the Turing Award, but at least it would lead to some advancements, is just being able to better learn from the text that we're already given. So Right now, like I've been saying, we tend to learn translations from parallel data, and we get a reasonable amount of information from the data that we're given. We can identify word-for-word correspondences in the million sentence pairs that we have and identify a pretty good lexicon, but basically what we're learning from this data right now is word-for-word and maybe phrase-for-phrase translations and maybe something about reordering. But there's a lot more that's going on inside these parallel sentences. So they can tell us something about the phrase and constituency notion inside languages. They can tell us something about what kind of morphology occurs on words, so what sort of endings we use in practice and how they correspond with one another. I think there's a lot that we could learn, a lot more that we could learn about the mechanics of language and how it's expressed in one language, and also how they systematically differ between a particular language pair just given a data set. And it feels like this is an area that's sort of ripe for exploitation. Like, how can we automatically learn some slightly deeper structures? And when we do so, I think it has the potential to influence not only translation, but maybe also our monolingual analysis components. They can tell us something about maybe how a new language works and allow us to transfer some knowledge and ideas onto languages that we currently have no analysis for. So I think it could be interesting.
Yeah. So talking about like different languages. So something that seems to be, I think, a little bit out of fashion these days is like, you know, but in the 60s there was this idea of like having like a universal language that everybody would speak. Like, you know, I won't name names, but you know, do you think that something like that is feasible or? Because that would kind of eliminate all the problems.
Michael is first.
No, I mean, it's...
It didn't take off the first time, okay?
Making everybody learning a universal language is one way to have people communicate, right? But, I mean, with the advent of machine translation now, it's gotten useful to the point where you can actually translate a web page that's in Japanese or in Italian. You don't understand a thing, you have it translated, well, it's not going to come back in beautiful English, but it's hopefully going to come back in a way that you understand what it's about, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have tools like that that can actually help you with your daily information needs, right, that can really get you somewhere. I don't think teaching everybody, you know, the same universal language is feasible or doable.
And it comes at such a cultural cost, too, right?
That's true, because that is a synthetic language, which sort of... Yeah. You know, no matter how you design it as a human, it's going to have the shortcomings that, you know, using a programming language for communication will have.
Yes, exactly.
You
know,
that's what Eric wants, ultimately. He wants everyone to speak in Haskell.
No. Well, exactly. Yeah. But I felt that it always felt like, you know, very artificial. It's like, you know, not human. Mm-hmm. It's too constructed.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's too unambiguous.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. But talking about like beauty, one of the things that we often do in programming, so we talk about beautiful code, and you know, you talked about poetry, you know, that's sort of like beauty. So, is there a way that you can capture, you know, what does it mean for a sentence to be beautiful or elegant, or is that something that you try to kind of, you know, capture? Because that kind of goes beyond the kind of semantics, right? This is like it's hard to grasp what is beauty in. But still, if you read a text, right, you know, you can...
Oh, yeah,
you
I
see
mean,
it.
You read a novel, you just read a paragraph, and you know, well, this guy can't write, this guy can.
Yes,
you know?
So
a little bit, it's like what I was trying to get at with, if we had conversation as a target, each word that you use evokes a whole set of words. It evokes a small world. Mm-hmm. It evokes pictures. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that, you know, certain sentences are more evocative. That might be some measure. You know, so you could say some things are more or less evocative. They're more or less connected to the semantic networks that you can create. Other things are more repetitive. So that maybe it's there. It's in the network of words that are evoked but not mentioned by the sentence.
I think there's multiple levels. I mean, that's a level of the meaning of the words that you're talking about, which is a very, very big factor. But then there's also there's a structural beauty and structural elegance. And of course, one decoupled from the other would be absurd.
Yes.
You know, you can have a complete jumble, but it's you know, sort of interesting because the words have interesting associations, or you could have a very, very elegant sentence that says nothing.
Green ideas but sleep furiously.
Yes. they still do.
Yeah, but that means, like, how would you translate poetry?
You don't.
That's beyond.
But I mean, those are, that's like a canonical example of beautiful
construction. Yes, and as Chris is saying, you know, even humans really can't. I mean, it's very, very hard, right? Yeah. There's an attempt made, but it's not the same. Because the cultural connotations are always different.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the beauty, too, right? It's this interplay between your culture, between your understanding of the world and the thing that's in front of you. And how do you...
But when you think about it very pragmatically, I think there's even in that domain, there's something, if you scale down the problem, you can actually do something useful. And there's, you know, there are attempts to do that. There's people who come up with automatic methods, for example, to score essays, you know, and there is some notion in there about coherence, which has nothing to do with deep understanding, you know, it's not there. But you can get those scoring methods, and, you know, it's both coherence and also sort of the language, you know, how are your sentences structured, etc. You can get it to a point where it actually correlates quite well with human assessment.
Okay.
So you can use it as a tool. It's, you know, and it's only this much towards beauty, right? But it at least it correlates a little bit with the human assessment of what coherence and reasonable sentence structure would be in an essay. So that's, you know, that's something that you can do. But.
Yeah, because I'm, as a non-native speaker, that's often the kind of the hardest thing. You know, you feel that you master language up to a certain point, but you to get really that beauty and, you know, the elegance in your sentence, that's kind of, you know, that's kind of seems to be like out of reach.
Imagine how out of reach it is for the computer right
yes,
now.
Exactly. Okay?
You are in the world. It is not.
And speaking of, you know, trying to understand this conversation, conversations have to end. that would be a really hard thing to automatically figure out that, okay, the conversation needs to end now. So you would have a computer that would just talk to each other forever, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, well, the only thing that I'd like to maybe end on is this is all nice theoretical stuff, but, you know, you work for Microsoft and you're in the computer industry.
Oh, right.
So what is the end game?
Didn't we tell you we work in research?
Yeah. But I mean, it's important that people understand that the great work that you do is going to be applied to something that makes sense to the average person. And it has to be more than just search, right? I mean, so can we briefly just talk about what it is that you're targeting with all of this research?
Okay. Chris first?
Sure, well, I can talk about the thing that we've been working on. I mean,
yes.
I'll keep talking
very
about
concrete.
MT. Sorry, my last time about this topic. But,
machine translation.
Machine translation.
Yeah.
So for the company in particular, we develop a huge amount of content in English, and yet we're a global company. We deal with like 31 languages on a day-to-day basis now, and I'm sure that's going to continue growing over the years and decades to come. So just getting that content out to the people in the world who want to be able to use our software is a really important problem. So unfortunately, for a lot of this content, we simply can't afford to have it human translated into all the languages available. For the very basic information, certainly, but for every little bit of content, we just can't do it. So starting in 2002, I think, we began a partnership with formerly PSS, now CSS, the support site, to translate all their support documentation into Spanish and now into German, Japanese, Italian, Portuguese, Chinese, I'm sure I'm missing a couple others, just to make all this information available freely on the web to anybody who wants to use it. And so this has helped, later on we've also used it in post-editing scenarios, so first try to translate a content with the machine and then have a human come in and correct the translation. Mm. So this has helped Microsoft cut costs, it's increased information availability to our users, and generally it's helped communication a little bit worldwide. And so continuing to invest in this particular technology helps break down barriers between countries, it helps information disseminate more freely, and generally just improves communication. So I think that's a pretty exciting goal and a pretty concrete impact that a research group has made. So,
And now there's the translator website as well.
So we have a free version of our translator out on the web now that people can use.
We actually the dev team for Channel 9 is using that.
Good.
Or starting to think about using it.
Really, that's super.
Definitely.
That's super. Let's see. So what I have worked on in the past was very related to parsing. So this group is responsible for the word grammar checker that
cool.
came out of our group. And then we partnered with the product team. They took it the last, you know, the last several and very important miles. But we kind of set, so every time you type in a sentence in Word, it's parsed. Mm-hmm. We get the logical form for that parse. It's pretty astounding. Not many people realize that. So the grammar checker, I've worked on summarization. That hasn't made it out to products yet, but is an important piece of technology. So distilling a large body of text or multiple text on the same, roughly the same topic, give me one summary of that.
Cool. That, sort of like the important. Instant executive email.
That would that, yeah.
that
would
be very useful. I wish that was part of the Outlook.
Yeah, we're working on that too. Yeah, can you summarize this thread and
yes.
give it to me? You know, what do I need to know out
yes.
of these millions of emails?
Yes.
So yes, we're working on that, and I do work on search because it's simply a fascinating problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so for sentiment, there's two applications that I think that are very important. Number one, Microsoft actually gets huge amounts of customer feedback. And, you know, they come in through different channels, different groups deal with them in different ways. And we've written a Think Week paper a couple of years ago with a variety of different people, different parts of the company, basically pointing out that it would be great if we had, like, a central resource for automatic analysis of you know, textual feedback. Because we're getting such a high volume, you know, we can use automatic techniques. They don't have to be 100% or 90% accurate. With the amount of stuff that we get, you know, it would be great to get some results out of that
and
quickly.
So you mean like somebody that sends a really kind of, you know, angry email or is desperate
yeah.
and that
yeah.
you can kind of quickly filter out those and...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Find out the pain points. You
yeah,
can
okay.
if you do automatic analysis, you can do that actually very quickly because something may happen overnight, you know, in a service or you know
yes,
something,
yeah.
and it's important to react quickly to it.
Yeah.
There's also LiveSearch. The has a feature used to be called Opinion Index. Not sure what it's called now, but it's basically if you do product search, you can very quickly browse automatically analyze reviews for products that you're interested in. And it's a beautiful feature
mm-hmm.
that helps you really distinguish products. And for the ESL, for the English as a Second Language sort of proofing tools, this number is already old, but there used to be, you know, I'm sure it's more, 750 million speakers, non-native speakers of English versus about half of that as native speakers. So, you know, there's way more non-native speakers than there are native speakers, so there's a lot of demand for that. And wouldn't it be great if, you know, Office or, you know, any product that we have, actually, in addition to the regular grammar and spell checking and thesaurus capabilities, also had, you know, a component that is maybe geared towards ESL users and maybe shows examples from the web.
I noticed that you're
so
Dutch. Maybe you should kind of change. Yeah, that would be really good.
Well, another excellent episode of Expert to Expert.
Yes,
man.
This was really
thank
nice.
You.
Thank you very much, and thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This was a pleasure.
It was fun.
Okay.
It was a real pleasure.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay.
Cheers.